Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction with Steven and Scott. That is Steven, I am Scott.
Hey.
That's Steven. And we are here to discuss two very interesting sci-fi movies that are similar in some very key ways, but very dissimilar in tone, delivery, style, attitude.
Quality.
Quality. I was just going to turn it over to you, Steven. Steven, why don't you introduce the pairing to our listeners this week?
So, this week we're going back into space for two movies that are about a deep space mission to rescue a bunch of people who got themselves into trouble. Both missions go awry in very different ways. One of them is the sci-fi classic, the sci-fi horror classic, Paul W.S. Anderson's Event Horizon. And the other one is the underrated and underseen Danny Boyle, Alex Garland collaboration, Sunshine.
All right. So, Steven, aside from what makes these films very different, I think you touched on it. What makes them similar is that they're both about, like, ostensibly hard science adventures where a crew goes deep into space for a very important mission and discovers that there are survivors of a previous mission, and that causes all sorts of trouble.
Horror ensues.
Yeah, horror ensues in both films. All right, but we're starting off on Event Horizon, which, as you mentioned, is a Paul W.S. Anderson film. It was his first film after the hit that was Mortal Kombat. And so, well, Mortal Kombat made a lot of money. And
did
so,
it really?
Yeah. It absolutely did. And so what happens then is, you know, when your last movie makes money, a lot of times a studio will call you in and say, what do you want to make? And apparently Event Horizon was a screenplay sitting in on a shelf at Paramount. And Paul Anderson said, I like this. I'll make this. And they gave him money to make it. And it came out. It made very little money. Critics did not like it. But after that, beyond VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, cable, call it what you will, over the last 20 years, and I have watched it happen, like I have seen flowers grow in high-speed motion. This film has really built up a loyal cult following. I know, Steven, you're not a huge fan, and we'll get into that. And even I, who am a fan, think it's kind of sloppy here and there and a kind of threadbare in many spots, but I still do enjoy it. All right, so Steven, why don't you break down the plot of Event Horizon from a scientist's point of view?
Wait, what movie were we talking about again? I don't remember.
It's called Event Horizon.
Event Horizon? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that was... No, wait, what? Doesn't ring a bell. Sorry. I can't...
I think the gag he's going for here, movie fans, is that the film is so slight and forgettable that less than 15 minutes later, he's already forgotten it. So let's give him credit for that joke and move on.
True story. 100% true story. I saw this on the big screen at a film festival in December of this, or, you know, last year, like within the last 8 months. Scott and I talked last week about it. I literally could not have told you, other than Sam Neill, I could not have named a single person in the movie. I could not have named a single plot point beyond, you know, 2001 meets Hellraiser. I remembered nothing about the movie, nothing whatsoever,
so,
no specifics, because they're so generic, it's impossible to like.
As fascinating as it is to discuss giant holes in your memory, let us now discuss the movie you just watched less than 15 minutes ago.
Well, so it is, I believe, in the year 2050 or so, which is 30 years from now, and we have invented space travel that gets us to the far outer reaches of the solar system. And a ship goes missing out there, a mysterious research, military research type vessel. And Lawrence Fishburne and his crew are called upon to ferry Sam Neill out to find out what happened to it.
Right, right. In a lot of ways, it's very much like the Mary Celeste. It's a haunted ghost ship story. Like they went out there to find out what happened to the first ship, and they find it, and it's not good news. Turns out that the first ship has traveled into a dimension that us Earthlings would refer to as hell. Steven, does that sound accurate? That this spaceship somehow traveled through hell?
We know that it's hell because the people from there speak Latin.
Latin, right. Now, I, you and I have talked about this before, and I said, well, couldn't it just be some kind of dimension that we as Judeo-Christian creatures kind of extrapolate as hell? And you said, well, yeah, that would make sense, except they do speak Latin, which, as far as you know, is an earthbound language. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Dr. DeGennaro, why don't you tell our listeners, what exactly is an event horizon?
So an event horizon in this context is is basically this invisible barrier that surrounds a black hole. So a black hole, again, in this context, a black hole is it forms after a very, very giant star dies. It runs out of nuclear fuel at the center. There's nothing else that can sort of support the weight of the star crushing in on itself, and it compacts it all down to literally a single point, which we call a singularity. Now, that point has so much mass in such a small volume that it is so incredibly dense that even light cannot escape from it. And the event horizon is the radius outside of that singularity past which nothing can escape. So if anything falls in within the event horizon, it can never get back out again.
So, all right, let me ask you this then. Say you are a production assistant or an art director on Event Horizon, and you tell your friends, I'm working on a movie called Event Horizon, and they say, what does that mean? What is a layman, what would she say? What would that person say?
It's the surface of a black hole.
The surface of a black hole.
That's like wrong. You know, that's so simplified as to be incorrect, but it is probably the simplest way to sort of state it, I guess.
One of the more interesting early scenes in the film shows Sam Neill, who is a super scientist, explaining how they don't exactly travel faster than light. What they do is fold space. Now, why don't you explain this whole concept of how he's folding space and then punching a hole through the paper with a pen, and how that relates to the movie at hand?
Well, so this is a metaphor that gets used over and over and over and over in science fiction movies. Most recently, the most recent time I remember is in Interstellar, where somebody explains it to Matthew McConaughey. But the basic idea is, so space is obviously three-dimensional, but if you imagine that space is two-dimensional, if you wanted to get from one point to the other point, the shortest distance supposedly is a straight line, just along the surface of the paper.
Wait, let's back up. I know this movie is science fiction, but that's a big leap, that if you were to say that now 3D space is now 2D, well, then you could make up any rule if this apple
was... Well, no, but it's a metaphor. You scale it down to a dimension where you can understand what's happening, but the same sort of thing is happening in three dimensions, and it's just really difficult to visualize in three dimensions. But in three dimensions, you can theoretically, according to the general theory of relativity, bend space enough such that, like, two areas of space that are actually far apart from one another in three dimensions are close to one another in four dimensions, and you could theoretically, if you could poke a hole through that space, it's a little bit like, you know, if an ant is walking on the surface of a balloon, if he wants to get from one side of the balloon to the other side, he's got to walk all the way across the surface. But if he could poke a hole in the balloon and go through the middle of the balloon and then pop out on the other side, it would be a much shorter distance for him to travel. And so that's sort of the basic idea, but it's really hard to imagine what that, it's hard to wrap your brain around what that even looks like.
None of this sounds like science. All of this sounds like theory. There's no science involved here.
There's lots and lots of science involved here. In fact, your cell phone GPS would not work if this science was not correct.
Okay, so the movie starts out. They're on their way to go find this other ship, and they do. And what is it that they have found that the first ship has discovered,
Steven? So they come across a sound recording of... It's like the last transmission, and it's, you know, this garbled noise and people screaming, and then, you know, underneath it you can kind of hear somebody whispering I can't even remember now what the Latin was supposed to mean. I have already forgotten this movie.
save me.
Save me, right. They think he's saying save me. in Latin. And I think my biggest criticism of this movie is that it's trying to sort of be this science fiction thing, but then it throws on this extra layer of the religion and Satan and hell and Latin and Catholicism and cross imagery with Sam Neill in front of it. And like, it's like, okay, you know what? You could have a movie that was a science fiction movie about these guys that find this portal to this strange other dimension, and the things that live in this dimension are absolute evil and have a huge appetite and want to torture people and destroy people and whatever else. And like, that's a thing, and that could be interesting, you know? But the idea that like, okay, we're in the science fiction movement, and the gateway that they open is not just a gateway to this other unknowable Lovecraftian sort of dimension, but it's a gateway to the actual Judeo-Christian hell is just, it's silly. Yeah. It's a hat on top of a hat, and it really just doesn't work for me at all.
Let's run through the cast really quick, because this is, love this movie or not, this movie has a fun cast. Kathleen Quinlan at this point was in everything around this period. She probably best known from Apollo 13. She's great in that. Sam Neill, Lawrence Fishburne, Richard T. Jones as the comic relief, Jason Isaacs, which you had a note on Jason Isaacs. You were taken aback by what?
Well, so, you know, you think of him as sort of the bad guy. He's, you know, he's Lucius Malfoy. He's, you know, he tends to play sort of really badass bad guys. And he turns out to be, right, he's the one guy who, like, is smart enough to figure out what's going on, but also is...
He's a nice guy. He's a nice guy in this movie.
The other thing about this movie, I don't know who the protagonist of the movie is, because it starts with Sam Neill, but Sam Neill eventually ends up going crazy, sort of, maybe. I don't know. You know, that's another sort of hat on top of a hat aspect of this movie, because Sam Neill... is the scientist.
Well, Sam Neill plays Weir, and he was the original designer of the ship.
Right.
So that, you know, once he realizes that the ship has traveled literally to hell and back, it seems like he becomes almost like a mad Dr. Frankenstein, and now I have to protect my baby and find out what she knows, and he becomes, you know, a monster.
Sort of. Yeah, but he's kind of a jerk from the very beginning. And like, again, it's one of these things where like it feels like they didn't know which direction they wanted to take it. And so they kind of went both ways, because you could have gone with this as, okay, Sam Neill is, you know, he's this mad scientist who doesn't want his ship to get destroyed. He's all about, I got to get this thing to work, and is obsessed or whatever else. And through that becomes sort of accidentally evil. But instead, they kind of go like this halfway thing where it's like maybe he's actually literally possessed. And so like it's in this weird sort of muddled middle place where you don't know whether he's just, you know, an obsessed scientist acting of his own free will, or he's literally possessed by a demon. And that's why he decides to sort of start murdering people.
Another muddled thing that I I'm saying this from a guy who mostly likes this movie. One thing that I don't love is that once they arrive at the ship and discover that something horrible happened, we get these few gruesome, very memorable moments of visceral horror to give us a little clue as to what happened. And it is impactful and horrifying. But then the rest of the movie is pretty much a Twilight Zone riff on every crew member's worst fear is coming to get you. And I would rather it just kind of be like an alien monster chasing them down than this very hackneyed, oh, we're all being stalked by our worst fear.
Well, and all of their worst feels are the same thing. Like, literally, like...
Yeah, all past tragedies.
Right. Sam Neill sees his dead wife. Lawrence Fishburne sees a dead crew member that died on his watch. Kathleen Quinlan sees her dead son. Like, it's literally just the same fear repeated, like, four different times. And so it's not even interesting in that regard.
I think I would have liked it more if half the crew was still alive, just feral creatures who wanted to kill the humans, and they had to escape, you know, and just keep it more practical.
Didn't one of the people associated with this go on to make Pandorum, where that was basically the plot? Or am I?
Yeah, Paul Anderson produced a couple years later that as well, which I think is good. I like Pandorum, and we will cover it eventually. Let's talk about why do you think that this film has resonated beyond just a like forgettable sci-fi, like something like Supernova or Red Planet? Nobody really remembers those except serious sci-fi fans. Like, but something like this, if you bring it up, people like it. And I think it's not just I think part of it is it's got a great cast, and it does have those three or four really, again, brutal, visceral moments that are impactful and shocking. But I think the main thing is that it's a kind of a just visually cool mixture between sci-fi and like gothic cathedral type production design. I think it's an interesting visual mashup. I think that's why it became kind of a cable flick.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I feel like on a visual level, it rips off a lot of much better movies, in particular the Alien series. The production design is all just like straight out of Alien.
Yep.
And a lot of the effects, which is, you know, this is now 10 years later, which, you know, we did Aliens versus Starship Troopers. You know, so this is the same year as Starship Troopers, but a lot of the effects are worse than stuff that was in Aliens 11 years earlier or whatever,
yeah.
9 years earlier.
It also taps into, like, there's visual cues and themes to The Shining, to Amityville Horror. It's not subtle about the films that it's taking.
No, care. It's a thing that is not greater than the sum of its parts. So somebody at some point said, hey, what if we made like a 2010, but crossed it with a possession horror movie. And somebody said, sure, let's go grab all the possession horror movies and all of the space, alien movies, stick them in a blender and, you know, pour this slurry out onto people.
I like to look at it more like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. If somebody said, I want Tremors mixed with Little Shop of Horrors, and I would write that movie in a heartbeat. God, would I love to. But, you know, that's it. That's what they want. They want a smash. And that's what this is. This is occult horror plus outer space horror. And do I wish it had maybe darker and creepier ideas and something that didn't just fall back on... Again, I call it like the Fantasy Island thing of, oh, you know, it'll tap into your deepest fear. And it's like, well, now you just kind of become like a mini anthology film. Well, here's Jolie Richardson, and she has a fear, and now she's dead. And Kathleen Quinlan, she has a fear too. Ah, and now she's dead. And they all die in very perfunctory ways.
Yeah.
I know in a science point that you and I could talk about in any number of movies, but we might as well get to it now because there's a key moment in this movie in which it comes up. Steven, what precisely would happen to a human being if it got shot out of an airlock and it wasn't protected? What precisely happens to the human body and how would you expire?
Well, so this is, weirdly enough, so for all of the sort of my ragging on this movie, and there's plenty of ridiculous science in it that we'll get to, I don't think the movie did a great job of using its setting. If you're going to set a horror movie in space, like use the space setting in some sort of interesting way. And the one exception to that was the scene that you sort of just referenced, which is the kid whose name eludes me at the moment. Noseworthy, Jack Noseworthy.
Yeah, Jake Noseworthy. Yeah.
Gets trapped in an airlock and the outer door is about to open, which is going to decompress, you know, rapidly decompress him. And the decompression starts. And, you know, the science of this actually, in contrast to the movie we're going to talk about in a bit, actually gets it close to right. It certainly piles on the gruesomeness and the gore for visual effect, but largely what happens is kind of true. Like a lot of people think, I guess, that if you get out into space, you suddenly freeze, or that, you know, that freezing to death is the thing that you have to worry about most in space. But that's not true at all, because space, we call space cold. But it's not cold in the same way that, like, if you walked into a cold room or if you, you know, went into a meat locker is cold, because there's nothing there. It's space. It's empty space. It's a vacuum. And so there's no way for the heat from your body to go out of your body except by radiating away. So, like, if, you know, you're essentially like a little mini star, right, which is why you show up on an infrared camera, is that the heat that your body creates sort of gets radiated out into space, and that's how you lose your heat when you're in space. When you're on Earth, the actual molecules of air that are bumping into you that are cold will rob your body of heat much, much, much quicker. So essentially, he gets into this airlock. He's not going to freeze, but what is going to happen is there's pressure inside your body, and normally there's pressure from the atmosphere outside pushing in on your skin, essentially. And if you take that pressure away, suddenly, you know, there's things pushing outward, but nothing pushing inward. And so essentially you would start to swell, your capillaries would burst. So one of the things that Lawrence Fishburne yells like right before this happens is he tells him to expel all the air in his lungs, which normally when you see this scene in a movie, the person takes a big deep breath because, like, okay, well, I'm about to be in an airless environment. I need to take a deep breath.
Right, like you're, as if they're going underwater.
Right, but if you can imagine what would happen if you filled up a balloon. I mean, you can see this happen. Like if you fill up a balloon with helium and you let it go, it goes up into the air, and as it goes up into the air and the pressure decreases, the balloon actually starts to get bigger and bigger, and eventually when it gets high enough, it'll pop, and basically the same thing would happen to your lungs. If you took a huge breath right before you got decompressed, your lungs would essentially, like, you'd have all this air pushing outward on the surface of your lungs and nothing pushing inward,
right,
and poof, Yeah, it would kill you almost immediately.
So in space, the less air in your lungs, the better.
Yes.
So what you're saying is that Event Horizon got this right.
Yes, and again, it's more gory than it would be in real life, but you know, your capillaries bursting and your blood kind of starting to come out through your skin is a thing that would actually happen.
You said, you told me before that it would be like a giant hickey all over your body.
Yes, exactly.
Well, only a giant hickey times a million.
Yeah, kind of so I mean, exactly, right? If you give somebody a hickey, you're essentially bursting all the capillaries in that place by using vacuum pressure, and so if you can imagine that happening over the entire surface of your body from somebody who has the most suction of anybody you've ever met in your life, and you can start to get some idea of how gruesome and awful it would be to decompress in space. But so the thing is, because you have to expel all the air in your lungs, you have about 15 seconds of consciousness because you now have no oxygen getting to your brain. And so within about 15 or 20 seconds, your brain is just going to shut down because you don't have any oxygen. You'll pass out and, you know, that's it. You're done. So that's the good news. It's actually probably wouldn't be all that painful. You would just suffocate.
Steven, this film deals with black holes in a very interesting way. Let me ask you this. We discussed this briefly, and I promised that we would cover it on the episode. Explain why Superman could not escape from a black hole.
I mean, so nothing can escape from a black hole. That's like literally the entire point, right? So the way this works is, to escape from something, to escape from the Earth, to escape from a large body of gravity, you have to reach a certain speed, and that's what we call the escape velocity. And so, you know, for the Earth, it's a certain amount, and if you hurl something, you know, a rocket, and you get it up going faster than the escape velocity, then it'll eventually escape Earth's gravity. Well, the escape velocity for a black hole is literally faster than the speed of light, and which is why light can't escape it, which is why it's called a black hole. So there's a couple of reasons, I would say. Number one, unless that black hole happened to be close to a yellow sun, he wouldn't have any powers to begin with. He would just be a dude. And so he would just die falling into the black hole.
He'd just be a man oddly floating in space.
But the other reason is, again, unless he can, you know, he's purported to be faster than a speeding bullet, but that's not the same thing as being faster than the speed of light. And unless he's faster than the speed of light, which has never been established in any canon that I've ever seen, although, in order for him to get to Krypton, which is supposedly in a different galaxy, and back again in a reasonable amount of time, for instance, between Superman 2 and Superman Returns, he would theoretically have to be going faster than the speed of light. But then again, that didn't make any sense because as soon as he gets out of our solar system, he's no longer being powered by our yellow sun, and he's just a dude out in space, and he would explode like Jack Noseworthy in the airlock. So,
and I would like to remind our listeners that someday in the future, Stephen and I will cover Superman 1978, and he will explain what would happen if a superhero actually made the Earth spin backwards to change time.
I will not spoil that.
Stephen, you're a fan of planets, right?
Mostly, yes. Some of my best friends are planets.
Okay. And where would you rank Neptune on your fandom level?
it's out past Uranus but before Pluto.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't you explain Neptune's role in this movie and why it is problematic?
So, initially, in fact, I believe in the opening text it says something about how the ship got lost out past the orbit of Neptune. But then it turns out it actually literally is in orbit around Neptune. And then when they get there, it's not only in orbit around Neptune, it's literally just floating in the clouds of Neptune, which, you know, first of all, how does that even work? Like, it's literally inside the clouds. They see the clouds part and there's the ship right in front of them. And it's like, if it was inside the clouds of Neptune, it's not flying like an airplane would fly. And therefore it's just sort of sitting there. It's basically like, if you turn the engines off of an airplane, what would happen? It would just plummet to the ground.
Right. If it was in, if it was in orbit, it would float. If it was in atmosphere, it would plummet.
Yes, exactly. So there's your first clue that this movie is not taking its science very seriously. But more to the point, the reason why they send the ship out that far away is because they're going to create a black hole, right? And they decide, okay, well, it would probably be a bad idea to create a black hole anywhere near Earth because that would be a problem. So they go and they send the ship out, and rather than sending it out to, like, you know, the orbit of Neptune is gigantic. You could go to the exact opposite side from where Neptune is and you'd be far away from everything. But instead, they actually put the ship in orbit around Neptune and then create a black hole, which, like, guys, it's really, like, if the whole point of this is to try to be safe, that's a terrible idea, because now you have built a black hole right beside a giant gas planet. And if something goes wrong and that black hole escapes or is more powerful than you think it is, or it destroys the ship or whatever else, you now have a black hole right next to a giant source of fuel, essentially, basically a giant ball of hydrogen. And as the black hole, you know, spirals into Neptune, all of that material is going to fall onto the surface of the black hole, get heated up to millions of degrees, turn into X-rays, and essentially you're going to have a supernova like right here, you know, which the
it's not good, not good for property value.
Which would, from a scientific point of view, means you're screwed.
You're done. Right. Steven, how would human beings go about creating a black hole?
They wouldn't. I mean, like, we don't. If there's any way that we could potentially possibly do it, the only thing that you could maybe do is if you smash a couple of atoms together at fast enough speeds. In fact, the people were worried at one point that the Large Hadron Collider at CERN might actually do this by accident. You could potentially create it like a micro black hole, like a little tiny black hole, and then it probably would just evaporate from Hawking radiation. But maybe you could keep it alive long enough to build it up into a bigger black hole. I don't know. In this thing, they talk about rotating magnetic fields and gravitons and a bunch of scientific gobbledygook that was, it's there for production design purposes.
I gotta wonder, and I mean this when lawyers watch law shows and when cops watch cop shows and when scientists watch, sometimes you're like, yeah, that science makes sense. That science, and then a paragraph comes along where you're like, oh, you just threw like a bunch of terms on a paper like Scrabble, but, you know, just a bunch of terms thrown together like, well, the audience doesn't know what this means and that's good enough.
Well, you know, something like Star Trek at least has sort of the advantage of being so far in the future that they can make up a bunch of words or, you know, talk about things that don't actually exist or combine, you know, concepts that do exist into something, you know, that you could potentially project as happening in the future. They don't really have – Event Horizon is supposedly takes place in 2049, I think. That's 30 years from now. So like when my kid is, you know, not even middle-aged yet, and I don't think we're going to have gravitron-focusing rotating magnetic fields that can create black holes in another 30 years. So,
Steven, let me ask you this. You've bought a car before, right?
I have.
Okay. When you bought a car, was there ever an optional self-destruct system?
In fact, both of my cars have, yes, there's a self-destruct
button. You have a pool. You have a pool for your family, right? Did that pool come with a sudden collapse system in case of an emergency? Because here's the thing. It's one of the weird movie shorthand tidbits, or call it what you will, cliches, definitely a cliche, that we've accepted over the years, which is that every single spaceship ever built, for some reason, has an elaborate but simply accessible self-destruct system. Why? Why? Why would your spaceship come with a self-destruct system?
Those are standard on American military aircraft carriers. It's the sink button.
I really don't think they are.
If you look like you're, you know, if it looks like you're going to crash into an iceberg, you just hit the sink button and then you're sinks.
I mean, okay. I am no expert on naval history, but I know that there have been times in naval warfare in the past when you have to, what they call, scuttle a ship. You have to destroy your own ship or one of your own ships for whatever reason. And I get that, but every single movie, find me a movie spaceship that doesn't have a self-destruct system for some reason, and you can be a guest on our podcast. There we go. So, yeah, like most sci-fi movies, this one has an elaborate but yet oddly accessible self-destruct system. Steven, is there any science behind this? Do you know of anything else in the real world that comes with a self-destruct system?
I mean, digitally, I guess there are, you can have a hard drive that's encrypted where if you guess the password wrong too many times, it wipes out all of the data. But that's not quite the same thing.
I mean, do you think that aircraft carriers, rather than being rather than having them fall into enemy hands, there is a system that would just blow out the bottom of the ship?
Look, even if that were true, aircraft carriers are military vessels. They're not salvage vessels. They're not scientific vessels.
Cargo ships, right?
So it would be like having a self-destruct button on the Exxon Valdez, which, you know, besides being superfluous because it self-destructed all on its own, would just be silly and unnecessary.
All right, let's end Event Horizon. I'm glad we covered this movie because it has a lot of fans, but even though I like it, it is kind of paper thin. I would call it for entertainment value. I would give it, it holds up for me. I give it a B-, despite its flaws, despite its obvious inspirations and some sketchy effects and thin writing. I still like it. It's just dumb fun, and I'm fine with that. And for Scientific Intelligence, I'm going to say, like, D+, and turn it over to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the very definition of a C student. In fact, I had, when I used to teach high school, like I remember most of my A students and I remember a lot of my failing students, but there's a whole mass of students in the middle where, like, if they walked up to me today and said, "Hey, you taught me 15 years ago," I'd be like, sure, I believe you because you have no reason to lie to me, but I don't remember you. I mean, I wouldn't say that out loud, but that would be what my thought was. And that's kind of how I feel about this movie. It's not really trying hard enough to get a B or an A, but it's not even bad enough to sort of be memorably bad. It's just this sort of very blah, I don't know. It's just a nothing of a movie to me that literally just disappears from my brain 15 minutes after I watch it every time.
To me, you know what? We could come up with a term for that. And that, to me, we'll call those a game show movie. Because, Steven, I'm not embarrassed to admit that I really enjoy game shows. I do. I sometimes can't focus. I sometimes have depression. I like game shows. They're distracting and they don't require much heavy lifting mentally. But yet, if you were to say to me, "Hey, what three game shows did you watch last week?" I'd be like, because they're just empty calories. Yeah. You don't remember them.
And and then on Scientific Intelligence, I would say I would probably have given it a D, but that one scene again, like it's one of the few movies I've ever seen get something about decompression in space right. And so I'm going to give it, a plus just for that. So D+.
All right. There we go. Now we're going to move over to, as we mentioned, a slightly similar but much superior. I'm going to speak for Steven for the following 30 seconds when I say we both like this movie a whole lot more than Event Horizon. It's Danny Boyle's Sunshine. Steven, I'll break down the plot, but why don't you just real quick give me one sentence on your thoughts on Sunshine.
Good.
That's a sentence. Good is a sentence. And Sunshine is about that the sun is dying. So we send a spaceship to kickstart the sun. And it's the second ship. The first ship failed. And this is humanity's last chance. And it's crewed by a staff of brilliant scientists and pilot technicians, what have you. And it's the entire world is at stake kind of mission. And the whole thing is one thing goes wrong, a relatively minor thing goes wrong, and it leads to a really interesting domino effect of terrible things going wrong. And can these this dwindling number of astronauts, can they somehow manage to avoid destruction and save the day?
My guess is not, and you know why, Scott?
Why?
Because they called their ship Icarus.
Okay, yeah, any sci-fi geek who is also halfway conversant with Greek mythology knows the story of Icarus and Daedalus and the wings that were glued together, and he flew too close to the sun. Hubris leads to your downfall. Everybody knows it. It's symbolic. It's metaphor. It's great stuff. But here's the thing. If you have the stones to call your first spaceship Icarus and send it out to the sun, and then it goes missing, and then you have to build a second ship and send it out, don't call it Icarus too. Just don't. It's just,
that's like naming your boat Titanic 2 and then sending it into the Arctic.
All right. I just don't get it. The first time you call your spaceship Icarus, I get it. You're meant to be ironic and, it's hubristic to call it. But by the time you lost the first one, drop that, man. Call it Desperate Hope. Call it, oh my God, we're sorry.
Call it whatever the opposite of Icarus is.
Yes, the opposite of Icarus. Call it Suraki. All right.
So I don't know that they ever actually address this in the movie. I don't think you've ever seen it written. But in my brain, I imagine that it's not Icarus, like Icarus II or Icarus the number two, but it's Icarus T-O-O.
Oh, it's a grammatical joke.
Okay.
Much like Event Horizon, Sunshine has a fantastic cast, although, and I think Steven will agree with me, they're given much more interesting dialogue in this film. Even though they are kind of thinly drawn, just as they are in Event Horizon, they're still thinly drawn in an intelligent way, whereas in Event Horizon, they're all kind of thinly drawn in a very TV pilot kind of way.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I mean, in fact, I wouldn't because I don't think that they're thinly drawn at all. I think that they are actually very well drawn. I think that there's a lot of stuff that happens among these characters, especially even very early on, where you sort of really get a good sense of who everybody is. You have, you know, Captain America is the sort of like no-nonsense, I don't even know what his actual role on the ship is.
He's the engineer.
Okay. He's Mace. All right. He's in charge of the, like, I guess he's in charge of the ship. No, but he, you know, he very early on. So, you know, plot wise, what happens is that they're, you know, on their way to the sun for the second time, and they receive a distress signal from the Icarus One, and they have to decide sort of very quickly: do we go and try to go to Icarus One, or do we continue directly on our mission to the sun? And, you know, Captain America very rightly points out nothing is more important than this mission. Literally, the fate of humanity rests on it. My life doesn't matter. Your life doesn't matter. The lives of whatever crew members may or may not be alive on Icarus One do not matter. The only thing that matters is we have to deliver the payload, restart the sun. And you and I have talked about this in a couple of other movies, you know, where the astronauts on these sort of life or death Earth-saving missions don't fully appreciate that their own lives are expendable, or that, you know, that the importance of the mission outweighs all other considerations. And this movie gets that right in a really interesting way.
Oh, I totally agree. The writing, this is written by Alex Garland, who our sci-fi fans will know from Ex Machina and Annihilation, who is a fantastic filmmaker. And he can do a lot of heavy lifting character-wise with very few lines. And I think this is a much better screenplay, much better written. It's just that I would have liked more scenes. I would have liked a little bit more, like, give me, there are deleted scenes on the Blu-ray that like feel a little dry and a little dull outside of the film. But I think just like in Alien, which gives you enough time to let these characters breathe, I could have used another 10 or 15 minutes of these characters, partially because they are so well written. But it feels like this film was really cut to the bone. That's not necessarily a bad thing, because it is very tight and efficient, and once it gets moving, very suspenseful and intense. So, Steven, let's start out with this science question. The sun is dying. True or false?
I mean, in the sense that, like, you and I are dying, and everything that is alive dies eventually, yes, it's dying. In the sense that it will happen imminently, or could happen suddenly and without warning, no. The sun's about 4.5 billion years old. It'll live probably for about another 4.5 billion years before it runs out of fuel. And we, you know, those numbers are not speculative. They're based on some very well-established principles of physics, as well as our ability to observe, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of other stars in the galaxy surrounding us and seeing what their life cycles look like. So we're pretty confident in those numbers. There is nothing that I'm aware of that could make the sun, you know, the sun is actually a very simple mechanism, really, when it comes down to it. It's a giant ball of hydrogen that is falling, you know, that is has enough of its own gravity that the center of it gets heated up so much that it starts to be able to burn that hydrogen in a nuclear reaction and turn it into helium and release a bunch of energy. And so it's actually very sort of simple. And the ability to sort of calculate what's going on in the sun, to first order at least, is not very difficult. So, you know, the idea that some unexpected thing could come along and make the sun die within the next 100 years is certainly outside of the realm of any understanding we currently have of the way nuclear physics or astrophysics works.
Okay. And the film is oddly evasive about exactly what's wrong with the sun. I got to assume it was in an earlier draft. You mentioned that you read the screenplay, but it's never...
Well, so I don't think it's ever addressed in the thing, but I do believe that... So there's a commentary track with the person that they hired to be the scientific advisor on the film.
Dr. Brian Cox.
Who is an astrophysicist, a nuclear physicist.
I think it was particle.
Yeah, so they did not ask an astrophysicist, which, you know, might have been a better idea than a nuclear physicist or particle physicist. But I guess he came up with some sort of theoretical thing called a cue ball, which is a thing that theoretically could exist, but there's no evidence whatsoever that they actually do exist in nature. Maybe, I guess. I don't know. But let's say that that did happen. The idea that you could take a bomb, and they described the bomb as the size of Manhattan, which presumably must mean like a cube whose dimensions are the size of Manhattan. I don't like.
Is it the same dimensions of Manhattan from the Deep Impact asteroid?
No, that was just from Battery. That was just from Battery Park up to the top of Central Park.
Okay.
This is all of Manhattan, I guess. Right, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. And no mentions of the limestone of Missouri.
Right. Well, so aside from the like ridiculous impracticality of actually mining that much fissile material, the sun is like unimaginably gigantic. And the idea that you could restart it by dropping a bomb essentially on the surface of the sun, right? Because you're not going to be able to get this thing very deep into the sun before it's going to just explode on its own.
Wait, but am I wrong in assuming that, like, let's just say that you were completely impervious to heat. There is no surface. It's burning gas, right?
Right. Well, so there's what we call the photosphere. So what we think of as sort of the surface of the sun is essentially the place where the light that's being generated by all this heat inside the sun is actually able to escape. And so it looks to us like the surface of the sun, because that's where, that's the place that we see. The sun itself, right, you know, continues well past that. But that's sort of what we think of as the surface of the sun. But regardless, whatever you want to call it, the point is that, you know, where all of the nuclear stuff happens in the sun is in the dead center of the sun. And the idea that you could, you know, and that's millions of degrees. There's nothing that we could possibly build that could survive a journey that deep into the sun without just completely melting and you know, being destroyed. So the idea that, like, you could just, you know, set this bomb off 1% of the way into the sun at most, and that would somehow restart fusion in the core of the sun is probably not very realistic. Let's just put it that way.
I really like this movie, and I always thought it might be more believable if you just kind of explain the science like, no, we're not, the bomb is not like kickstarting the entire star. It's kind of relighting the pilot light.
Maybe.
But yeah. I love the epic nature of the quest. I love that it is impossible to believe, but it's like this deep sci-fi fantasy concept of kickstarting the sun. Of course it makes no sense, but it is so much fun to think about. It is such a lofty idea, you know?
It's weird, you know, because again, this suspension of disbelief, as we've talked about many times, is very weird, because I never had a problem with that. And in some ways, like, once you start with that as the premise, you go, okay, this is, I'm going to put this in the bucket of not realistic science fiction movies.
Right.
And enjoy what is happening, you know, in terms of what's going on. And, you know, the character interactions, the writing, the direction are all so, and the production design, the visual effects are all so spectacular that, like, it very quickly sort of fades to the background. It's like, all right, well, you know what? This is an impossible mission, but it's science fiction. And so I'm going to go with the fiction part and not worry about the science part.
And like you touched on, once the audience buys the sun is dying and we have something that can possibly kickstart it, like a giant nuclear bomb, once the audience buys that, they can buy a lot.
Well, and they have to in this movie because there's a whole bunch of stuff.
No, because, like, once you buy that ticket, you're, like, willing to suspend a lot of disbelief. And that, you know, the fact that this movie really does not deviate, you know, it has some crazy ideas about what to do with sci-fi, but it also treats its audience, like, with some intelligence. It's not a dumb movie, even though it is based on a rather silly concept. It's not a dumb sci-fi movie by any stretch. And Event Horizon kind of is.
Yeah, well, so what, you know, I think, obviously Alex Garland is a very smart dude. I don't think Alex Garland knows a whole lot about science. And that's the difference between sort of just not knowing a thing versus not being, either not caring about it or not being smart enough to even know it. And so, like, clearly the movies themselves are smart enough that, like, the fact that he doesn't understand the particular science behind the thing is, at least in the case of this movie, is not something that bothered me. We'll get to some other of his movies where that bothered me a little bit more.
One of the things that I really like about it, and I like to get the science angle, is that the roadblocks that these types of movies, and this is, you know, the credit to the screenwriters, the roadblocks that you put up in your space quest, all right? So in this film, they're on their way to the sun, and then unexpectedly, they realize that, whoa, there's the first ship. Now they have two options. They can either go directly to their original location and try and plant this bomb under the sun, or they can subvert their missions temporarily, go to the Icarus One, take the second bomb, and now they have two chances in case something goes wrong.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, that's the argument that Cillian Murphy makes is, you know, if they're, or actually I think Cliff Curtis makes it first and then Cillian Murphy eventually signs off on it, right? Is like, it's not about trying to save the Icarus One crew. It's okay, there's a second payload there. Theoretically, that means we have a second chance if the first bomb doesn't work. Although, I don't see why you'd have a reason to believe if the first bomb didn't work that the second bomb would. But, you know, that's ultimately why they decide to do it. And then, of course, Benedict Wong messes up the calculations for how to – yeah.
Now, that's what I wanted to ask you about. It's really kind of intricate how everything starts to fall apart. At first, they plan, okay, we're going to go to the Icarus One and explore it and get the second bomb. And then the mistake that Benedict Wong makes is what?
Well, he apparently forgets to that, you know, that will change their angle of approach to the sun, which means that the shields are now at the wrong angle. And so
let's try and put that in really human terms. Imagine that if just forgetting to put on your right turn signal all of a sudden burnt your car to a crisp.
Yeah. Essentially.
And he's one of the most – he's such a good actor. And most people know him from Doctor Strange, but he's in a lot, he's so good in lots of things. And he has this – the role where he is essentially, unless they can fix this, he is the murderer of mankind.
Yeah.
Not intentional, completely accidental.
Well, the manslaughterer of mankind.
Yeah, the killer, the unintentional killer of mankind. And he's only got a few more scenes in the film and he's heartbreaking.
Yeah, just, it is. It's the scene where he admits to the mistake, you know, is just... It's so powerful, just emotionally, this moment of him just like, I effed up.
Well, you know what? We did it for the last movie. We got to run through everybody else. Cillian Murphy as Robert Capa, the physicist who is super brilliant. And Steven, you probably love him because he's like, that's your Han Solo, right?
Well, so, you know, one thing I do want to point out from a scientific point of view that is completely unrealistic is the color of Cillian Murphy's eyes. His eyes are bluer than is scientifically possible in the universe.
Ooh.
Somehow.
He is handsome. He
Seriously,
is a handsome man.
Like they must have super color corrected his eyes because there are a couple of scenes where his eyes just look like they're made out of like sapphires.
What do you think of his portrayal? Because you don't, he's super brilliant and he's so quiet. But when he talks, every other character listens.
I mean, he's great. Whatever. Cillian Murphy is awesome in literally everything that he's in. So it's no exception here.
It's a credit to Boyle, Garland, and Cillian Murphy is that they mention once or twice that he's super brilliant or whatever, and it's just assumed that everybody on this trip is the top of the top of the chain.
Yeah, there's no Steve Buscemi on this.
This is a truly, I mean, it's an international crew in every way, and what's interesting is that there's, you know, you get the impression that Chris Evans is the top engineer of the top engineers. Period. Like, we don't need a 20-minute or a 10-minute flashback explaining how he's the best engineer ever.
Yeah.
Michelle Yeoh is the biologist who tends to the oxygen garden. And I find this one of the most fascinating aspects of this movie. And credit to Dr. Cox and Alex Garland, how they got this right. Explain how, in theory and in practice, how an oxygen garden works in a spaceship.
Well, so, you know, the problem in space, obviously, is that there's no atmosphere. You know, on Earth, you can breathe in oxygen and you breathe out carbon dioxide and, you know, there's enough atmosphere all around you that it all just kind of, you know, works. It wouldn't if we stayed here long enough and there were no plants though, right? Because one of the things that plants do is that they pull the carbon dioxide back out of the air and release oxygen. And so we have this sort of symbiotic relationship. Now, normally on a spaceship, if you look at, you know, there's a scene, in fact, famously in Apollo 13, where their carbon dioxide scrubbers aren't working. So it turns out the problem in space, the bigger problem in space than a lack of oxygen, is carbon dioxide poisoning. When you inhale oxygen and you exhale carbon dioxide, you can imagine like if you did that into a balloon like over and over and over again after, you know, three or four times, you start to get lightheaded and your lungs start to hurt because now you're just basically breathing back in the carbon dioxide that you just exhaled. And so you have to have some sort of system that takes the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And on long-term space trips, one of the ideas that people has is this thing, you know, is the thing like an oxygen garden where you literally just have plants doing what they do here on Earth on a smaller scale, which is pull the carbon dioxide out of the air and turn it into food, essentially, because that's how they make the sugars that become our food, the carbohydrates that we eat, and then put oxygen back out into the air. And so her job is to tend to this group of plants that are essentially keeping, you know, essentially a living life support system for the humans.
It reminded me, and I just want to touch on it because I haven't seen it in many years, but an older film from the 70s called Silent Running, which is about basically a space gardener, and hopefully we'll get to that movie one day, but it's not a new concept. And do you know if it's been used in any practical method?
I mean, we haven't had any need to. I don't believe it's been used in any practical method. It wouldn't surprise me if they had done some sort of small-scale experiments on the International Space Station, but no, like for the most part, like it's mechanical systems and chemical reactions and whatnot that we use to perform this same sort of function. For, you know, for small-scale things that are relatively short-term, like space shuttle launches and whatnot, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because plants are, in some sense, going to be more unreliable and a lot more difficult to take care of than a system that's designed specifically to do this thing. So
right. But yeah, I think the idea, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the idea here is that the oxygen garden kind of implies that this is a long journey.
Yes, exactly. Although that in itself, one of my notes was, it seems a little too long to me, just in terms of how long it would actually take to get a mission to the sun. So the thing about the sun is that it's a giant mass, right? So if you want to get to the sun, essentially all you have to do is fall to it. So you have to lose, you know, the orbital speed that the Earth has, and then you would kind of sort of spiral in. So it wouldn't really be a particularly long journey, I don't think. But I didn't, you know, without doing the calculations, a couple months seems like it might be a bit long, but it's not like completely unreasonable.
Before we get into Act 3 of this movie, which has been controversial among genre fans, let's do this, Stephen. I'm going to pretend that you are Kappa. You know, you're in Dr. DeGennaro. It's not Kappa anymore. I want you to rate your fellow crew members. So how would you rate the performance of James Mace, as played by Chris Evans, the engineer?
I would rate him a 1 for beard and a 10 for engineering.
and heroics. I think I love Chris Evans. Obviously, he's the captain. I love him in Captain America, but I also really like his non-Captain America choices. Once the guy had the ability to kind of pick and choose what he wanted, he still chose stuff like this and Snowpiercer and Odd Things. And I like that very much about Chris Evans, and I really look forward to seeing what he does now that he's out of the Marvel universe, per se. All right, well, aside from Chris Evans, who's great in this, at first you really kind of don't like him because he's given Cap a lot of trouble. But every scene that Mace, Chris Evans, is in, you like him more because he makes the logical choice, the heroic choice, the noble idea. He's a good guy. He's a good soldier.
Well, he's right. He's the guy who's right, you know. And in a lot of movies, you know, I'm looking at you, 2012, Oliver Platt, you know, the guy who's right about, hey, you know what, nothing's more important than the fate of humanity, including our lives.
Well, yeah, they make this character is always made out to be callous and cold.
Right. He's made to be the villain, right. But in this, he's not.
But you know what? If he's the engineer on a ship that could save all of humanity, I want him to be like that. I don't
want
him.
You want everybody on that ship to be like that. And in some sense, they sort of are. There's an amazing scene towards the end of the movie where they have to decide that, you know, the computer tells them that they only have enough oxygen for 4 people. And Michelle Yeoh is still there, and Rose Byrne, and Kappa, and Captain America. But Benedict Wong is still alive, but he's completely, you know, almost comatose at this point. And so the decision is they have to kill Benedict Wong so that he won't be using up oxygen so they can make it all the way to deliver the payload. And they have this really amazing scene where Chris Evans is like, it's got to be unanimous. You all know, you know, what the stakes are.
Yeah.
And he makes them all vote. And at first it makes it look like Cillian Murphy is going to say no. But then Cillian Murphy's like, no, of course we do, because when we were weighing one man's life against all of humanity, of course we do it. And Rose Byrne is the one who says, no, I can't do it. And then Chris Evans is like, okay. And he does it anyway. And she gets so upset. But she also, again, you get the sense that like these are real people making a really, really difficult decision.
You know what? But also beyond that, it also feels like kind of bigger than these characters, which is one guy who is clearly a good man says, yes, I'm willing to let you kill him to save humanity. And then a woman who is clearly a good woman says, no, I do not give you permission. And then a second man who is also good Right. None of these people are motivated by bad things.
Right, he's exactly.
And then the second man says, no, I'm going to do it, and that's my call.
Yeah, I mean, that's good writing because you understand every single one of those characters. You understand why they're making the choice that they're making, and you empathize with every one of them because it's the most difficult choice that probably anybody in the world has to make in a lot of ways.
You can almost sense Garland and Boyle like having fun with, wow, we've really set it up so that these characters literally control the fate of humanity. And now we're just having fun kind of stretching and shoving and pushing and like massaging the clay where we want it to go. And it's fun. It's a fun movie. And then, okay, so...
So let's talk about the last act.
Right. All right. And then we move into act three, in which we will meet Pinbacker, as played by Mark Strong. Barely recognizable at all. I doubt you'd even know it's him. But so... One of the complaints or even just comments about this movie is that it's sci-fi for a solid hour, and then it turns a sharp left turn into full-bore sci-fi horror. Like, it's a horror movie. There's no way around it. Act three of this movie is a horror movie. And that bothers some people. It feels incongruous or atonal or just, you know, completely out of left field. I get that. Having seen the movie now four times, doesn't bother me. I think that it's an interesting dark turn.
Yeah, I mean, it feels very organic to the story to me. So they go, you know, they eventually hook up with the Icarus One. They go over there to sort of find out what happened, and they, you know, the entire crew is there dead. They're all in the sunroom. They've been baked alive, essentially, in the sunroom, and nobody knows why or what happened. And as they're exploring the ship, somebody blows the connection between the two ships, and nobody knows who it is, and they assume obviously that it was one of their crew, and so the movie kind of puts you in this position where you're thinking, okay, well, it's kind of a whodunit, like, well, somebody on their crew is sabotaging them for some reason, and then the survivors end up back on their own ship, and the computer insists that there's an extra person on board the ship, and that's when Kappa realizes, oh crap, one of the crew from the Icarus One came over onto our ship and is now killing people.
Yeah, it was not only was the saboteur, but is now also on our ship.
Right.
And I think that's a really cool, creepy moment. And then it turns out the survivor is the captain of the first ship who had been devoured by his obsession to the sun. He believes that the sun is his god and he wants to kill humanity so he can be the last remaining human.
He basically has, what did they call it in Armageddon? Space
dementia.
Space dementia. Yeah, so there's this whole kind of subplot going on throughout the entire movie, which is part of the reason why I think this tonal shift works for me, is because they sort of set up this idea from the literally like frame one of the movie where Cliff Curtis kind of has this sort of addiction to standing in the sunroom, you know, where they can actually look out at the sun and there's a filter, you know, blocking out the worst of it. And throughout the course of the movie, he starts to sort of develop blisters and sunburn, and you get this idea that he just loves sort of sitting in this sunroom. And so the logical sort of conclusion of that is what ends up happening to Pinbacker, where he becomes addicted to this sunroom and to the sunshine and goes crazy as a result.
It's an interesting theme, I think, because there's two ways to look at it. The Cliff Curtis character and the Mark Strong character, both of them have this weird addiction to the sun. At once, it seems like a drug addiction, and then later in the film, it almost seems like a religious epiphany. And I think that it's an interesting theme, because obviously few things in the universe are as powerful as sunlight. So you can see how, you know, these characters have become completely...
Well, cultures have literally worshipped the sun as a god since the dawn of civilization, so, and probably even before that.
All right, so devil's advocate then, Steven. Somebody says, I really like the film up until the part where, like, there's now a guy covered with giant sun tumors running around stabbing people in the back. Eh. That, you know, like, that's the complaint that I see most commonly about this film, and it's a fair complaint.
I mean, not everybody's going to like every movie. I think that, you know, Danny Boyle is an artist who makes bold choices, and certainly not all of them work. He has entire movies that don't work for me at all and other movies that I think are fantastic. And so, like, you know, not every choice is going to resonate with every person. So it's fair criticism, I guess, in one sense, but I don't even know what that means. It just means that you didn't like the movie. It doesn't mean that somebody else can't also like that. For me, I like tonal shifts in movies. Like, it's one of the things that I like, that I look for in movies when they're done well. They can, and I feel like it's done well here.
I think it's the film critic in me that where I'm watching a film where most of the scenes are given time to play out and play themselves, and then all of a sudden there's like a giant Hulk behind her and he kind of like stabs her in the back and she falls forward, which to me, that scene kind of feels like an afterthought or a reshoot. And that character maybe deserved more of a more interesting demise than just kind of a Jason kill.
Well, the movie goes out of its way in that last act to not ever fully show you Pinbacker. And I don't know how much of that was, you know, an artistic choice, you know, that they went into it knowing, you know, Danny Boyle knew, knowing that that was what he was going to do, or how much of it was a sort of reaction to the footage that they got and they, you know, they were editing. I suspect it was probably somewhere in between, but mostly on purpose. But, you know, he basically looks kind of like Frank from Hellraiser. He looks, you know, it's just his skin has all been completely burned away, which, by the way, is different than what was actually in the script. In the script, he is literally covered in melanoma and tumors, and he's, you know, this grotesque, like, you know, which is more realistic from a scientific point of view than, you know, if your skin.
Right. And that, you know what? That leans into my, it's definitely a conspiracy theory. It leads into my theory that he got a lot of notes about Act Three, and one of the notes was, that is too disgusting. And one of the ways he found to minimize the disgustingness of Pinbacker was to put him behind all these golden shimmers and gleams, which makes sense thematically when we, the viewer, are watching the film. But then there are other moments where other characters are looking directly at Pinbacker and they see the same thing. And that doesn't really make sense.
I mean, it makes sense sort of in, I mean, it's especially cool in the scenes where he finds him in the sunroom of Icarus II, and like he, you know, the sun is blasting in there, and so it's so bright that he can't fully make him out or whatever. But then there are later scenes where like he just kind of, you know, Danny Boyle just literally uses this sort of like filmic effect where like he kind of looks blurry, and again, it's hard to know how much of that was an aesthetic choice right from the beginning, or like what you're saying, maybe they were going for a lower rating and that was his solution to it.
It kind of, to me, makes the film slightly more interesting, you know, because I do have these theories about the ending, but yet I still like what's there.
I think because of the style of the entire movie, right, because of the way he uses light to sort of represent, like you kind of feel the sunlight, like you can hear it on the soundtrack, you know, he uses this sort of super overexposed images and like you really sort of, you feel the sunlight as like this actual sort of presence. And so thematically, that last act to me fits in with that same sort of general idea of what he's going for aesthetically in the movie of this, you know, sunlight having driven this person crazy, that I think works better in a lot of ways than if it had literally just turned into sort of just a horror movie of this guy picking them off one by one in the last act.
All right. Final question about the sun, Stephen. How close could we get to the sun before we melt?
I mean, it depends on what kind of ship you're in, I guess. I don't know. I'd have to look up the numbers. I know that the bomb that they make, is weirdly, it doesn't entirely make a whole lot of sense because Kappa at one point goes into the bomb. Now, anybody who's watched Chernobyl knows that if you have fissile material, if you have like raw uranium, which this thing is supposedly made out of, just this giant chunk of uranium, which there's problems with that to begin with, because the whole point of nuclear weapons is that if you get enough uranium in one spot, it'll start a chain reaction that you can't stop. And so this, you know, this bomb somehow has to keep this uranium from going critical before they want it to.
You're telling me it wouldn't make sense to run atop a giant uranium bomb the size of a city park?
No, I'm saying it wouldn't make sense to, yeah, to go inside of the bomb. The idea that he has to, like, where the entire point of this thing was to deliver this bomb to some point in the sun and them all get away and survive. So the idea that he has to arm the bomb from inside the bomb seems like a really, really poor mission design to me. But the idea that he could be walking around in the midst of this giant thing of uranium throwing, you know, fast neutrons at all of his soft tissues and not have died from cancer or radiation sickness long before this point in the movie is, of course, unrealistic. But all of that aside, I don't know. I mean, you couldn't get very far. You could not get very close to the sun. You'd have to pass through the corona, which is millions of degrees, to get to the photosphere in the first place. And the surface of the sun is like 5,000 degrees, which is going to melt any metal that we could potentially even possibly imagine creating. So the answer is not very close.
All right. Well, we are going to wrap it up. Sunshine. For entertainment value, I give it a B+. I think it's one of Danny Boyle's most entertaining movies. It's got a great cast, a phenomenal score. I love the music to this film, man. It's John Murphy on Underworld. Is that right?
It feels like an Explosions in the Sky album.
It's fantastic. It moves pretty quick. It has some plot holes, but not, you know, so many that you'll sit there being annoyed because it moves so quick and offers a lot of interesting ideas and visuals and characters definitely check it out if you haven't seen Sunshine yet. And for scientific intelligence, I'll give it a B.
Yeah, I mean, scientific intelligence, this is one of those movies where, like, the scientific intelligence it's sort of bimodal, I guess, in a sense. There's some stuff that it gets right. But for the most part now, the science is all pretty terrible. It's probably a D. It's not any better scientifically than Event Horizon is. And in some ways, it's worse because they do actually have the guy freeze to death in space. But on an entertainment value, it's an A-minus probably for me. It's up there among my favorite science fiction movies. I love this movie. And I think, you know, when I really sort of think about it, I'm willing to forgive almost any amount of scientific inaccuracy if the psychological accuracy feels true to me. If the characters all feel like believable people making believable decisions in an unbelievable situation, then I'm willing to sort of forgive the unbelievableness of the situation because I feel like I'm watching real people as opposed to something like Armageddon or Event Horizon where, you know, it's just there are characters that I don't care about at best who don't feel like real people to me. And the, you know, the science being terrible is just sort of a poop cherry on top of a crap sundae. But this is a good movie, and so the fact that the science is terrible doesn't bother me at all.
Oh, did I say science B? I meant science C-. because it does get a lot wrong, but it does it with such confidence. Who cares? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I would love to see a director's cut that explains exactly what is wrong with the sun, because they never do. But beyond that, it's got so much cool stuff in it. Who cares? Sunshine and Event Horizon, a fun double feature. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to get some bonus episodes, you can go on over to patreon.com/Scott E. Weinberg. Steven and I are doing commentaries for every episode of Firefly. We're going to be doing some very cool expert interviews. And just thanks so much for listening. I'll let Steven sign us out.
Thank you guys so much, and we'll see you next week.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free, select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams, one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.